You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Harold Pollack, how are you doing?
Doing great. Great to talk to you.
Harold, welcome to the Glenn Show. Glenn Lauer here. I'm at Stanford University on leave from Brown University talking to my friend, colleague, interlocutor. You see him often here on the Glenn Show, one Harold Pollack. Recently, and congratulations, Harold, of financial advice fame. Harold has a day job and a night job. His day job is professor at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration, where he knows everything about public health and a lot of other stuff besides. And his night job is what? A financial advisor. We were talking about Bernie Madoff the other day. Anyway, yeah. We're just here to talk. We're going to talk for a while about various different things. I'm welcoming Harold.
Hey, great to see you.
Yeah. The book.
Yeah, so I'm selling a book. It's interesting. So I don't have a copy within reach to wave.
But, that's all but right.
But no, it's not all right.
Neither do I, or I would be waving it.
It's an interesting thing. You know, our book is called The Index Card: Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. And I've been, you know, going on radio shows, and it actually does connect with my work. I'm doing a randomized trial where we're going to include some financial coaching for people to try to learn about how to help people manage their finances better. But you know, it's been sort of an interesting trip learning about marketing and going on a lot of radio shows and writing. I've been writing pieces in Vox and The Atlantic and some other places about.
You're getting a lot of play, Harold. a lot of play. You were mentioning before we went live here one particularly unusual experience that you had in some hip-hop venue somewhere or another that really struck my fancy. You want to tell us about that?
So I was asked to go on a serious radio show, and one thing that hadn't come over the transom was that it was a sort of shock jock hip-hop show, sort of like Howard Stern goes to hip-hop, and pretty much the first, you know, from the first sentence on, we're having an R-rated conversation, and
I think within, you know, some bounds of decency, but absolutely, I mean, for realism's sake, I think you should tell us what happened, Harold. We're dying to hear.
Well, I'll tell you, We start throwing around the vocabulary from the first sentence of like, okay, this is the first sentence virtually is, so Dr. Pollack, you're telling me if I put more in my 401k, I'll basically get a lot more dating success.
It was not quite, although with a more carnal probably inflection than what you rendered there.
Yes, slightly. I think you're sort of taken aback that I wasn't particularly offended. You know, I do urban public health.
Okay, I think we can put it this way. The guy said, am I going to get laid more often if I have more in my 401k? Something like that.
Which as a hypothesis is, you know, worth exploring.
is it?
And he ends it. I will, you know, reward our listeners. I explained at the beginning that he shouldn't call me Dr. Pollack because I'm a social scientist, and I'm always afraid that I'll be on a flight and somebody will be like, Dr. Pollack, the patient, and, you know, person in seat 14B can't breathe. You got to come and help us out. And I'm like, well, I could help him with his econometrics maybe. So he ends up, he says, Dr. Harold Pollack, he's a social scientist. He can't deliver your baby, but he can prevent you from being a broke mofo. And it sort of ends. And that's the end of the show. And what was striking, though, was that we actually had a pretty serious conversation where the guy was, you know, the host was, he was interested, and he was, you know, he was like, how do I save my money?
Financial literacy, man, you're doing the world a lot of good and probably getting paid besides. I'm not asking. I mean, I'm just hoping, I'm praying for you to be getting paid.
But what was interesting was that, you know, within the vernacular of, you know, of his milieu, he actually asked me good questions. And I think that we often make all sorts of assumptions about people based on the way that they talk and present themselves. He's like, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to save for my retirement. And, you know, I'm a disc jockey and this is my job, but, you know, what do I do? And he'd actually – you know, he had prepared, and it would be a good conversation. But anyway, it's been fun actually learning about some aspects of the marketing. I learned how to build a website. I made a nice website. I have a video talking about the fiduciary standard. I'm trying to various things so that regular people can see. Most of the issues we talk about are very straightforward, like just don't buy any individual stock. You know, anybody, if you've read Random Walk on Wall Street or...
Yeah, you should diversify. Is this the idea?
Yeah, you buy low-cost index funds, and they basically outperform everything else. And the data is so clear that you know, actively managed mutual funds do very poorly. But
people are getting utility out of the active management.
I think the managers are getting utility out of the active management. More
for sure.
And it really is remarkable. There's actually this is Odeon and Barber literature where they look at individual stock picking and how unbelievably bad everybody is. It's not just the guys in their basement, you know, in their pajamas doing gauge. It's all of us.
The ones with the suits and ties are also pretty bad at it.
Yeah, including the people that we pay to do it. And so some of the stuff is very simple, but some of it's not so simple, like the fiduciary standard. How do you explain that in a way that doesn't induce narcolepsy? So I made this little 3-minute video where I have this woman talking to her financial advisor, and she's got a cake, and the cake's got a big slice out of it. And the slice is basically the difference between what she would have in her retirement if she had bought low-cost index funds and what she's been paying him, to put her into actively managed funds.
And how big is the slice, Hero?
Slice can be pretty big. Over time, it can be almost 20%.
That's pretty significant.
There's a lot of course, there's a lot of debate about that.
Okay, let me ask you a question. This is my personal finance opportunity, which is basically I have all my money in a Fidelity set of funds, and they are actively managed, some of it, and they do charge a fee. Mm-hmm. And the return has been okay. I mean, it's been, you know, solid. But then the market had been, I mean, until recent debacle.
Yeah.
But am I making a mistake? Should I, like, pull it out and do my own, you know, and buy into some easily accessed, well-balanced mutual fund of the sort that you're talking about, not pay anybody any fees and just ride the market whichever way it goes without active management? One of the things they're doing to sell the management to me is about taxes and estate stuff. And, you know, I don't understand it well enough. And obviously, that's not what we're going to be talking about here. But just that, you know, a simple cut. Should I be having my hands on the money, or should I just give it over to Fidelity and let them do what they're going to do with it?
Well, I think in terms of investment success, the low fee index fund is going to beat out whatever you're doing now. So I would get on the web and take the hour that it's going to take to look at all your stuff and just figure out how much you're paying in fees. My guess is you're paying a little more than you think you're paying. But let me say what you really should do, and this is because you know you probably have a slightly complex financial life just because you're a successful professor and you're nearing retirement, however you want to retire, you know. I think what you really should do is find a fee-only fiduciary advisor and go to this person with your shoebox full of stuff for like 1 hour and pay them like $400.
That's cool, Harold. I see what you mean, because they have no ongoing stake in managing the money, but they're taking a lump sum up front in a modest amount to just give me the benefit of their advice and to get me on my own, you know, started out on my own 2 feet, so to speak. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. For the fact, I mean, I was going to make this behavioral economics remark, which is the way that the Fidelity people keep you hooked in, or at least keep me hooked in, is I've got my personal contact advisor, consular person, okay? I get to go in for meetings about my money, you know, three, four times a year if I want them, you know, and the person will hold my hand and walk me, and they've got these various, I'm an economist. I mean, I can see how simplistic and kind of Mickey Mouse the whole thing is, that they're selling, oh, you want this, and then they have all their spiels about, you know, your cycles and your retirement, whatever. I won't bore you. But I'm saying the contact is affirming somehow, you know. It's like, yeah, I mean, I'm important. You know, I get to park my car in the Mandarin Oriental Hotel valet for free across the street from the thing, stride in because I'm a big investor. You know, I mean, come on, it's really deep how they psych you out.
By the way, there's one of my favorite phrases is if it's free, you're the product.
Yeah, so, exactly. There is no free lunch. We know that.
But you know, the thing is, the advice that they give you might well be good, actually. And one of the best pieces of advice that they probably do give you, like right now during the debacle, my guess is this person that you're talking to is doing you a real service, because if you went in there and you're and you said, "I want to sell all my crap,"
you know, he that's would just exactly what they do.
Down.
Yeah, and, that, and he's stay than, calm, you know, please, you know,
he's cheaper than a mistake, and that's one of their sales pitches. But you should pay for the advice straight up and not mix that with the things. Yeah. They give often good advice, but it's mixed, but they make the money with the overpriced products. And that's sort of a bad combination. But one of the unfortunate side effects is that because so much of that, the fees are hidden, when they actually try to charge you straight up, you have a case of sticker shock. And the behavioral economics of being confronted with that makes it hard for the fee-only people. You know, if somebody says, "Hey, I want to charge you $1,000 to sit with me for an hour and a half because I'm really expert at your portfolio as a successful tenured professor," you'd be like, "Shit, you know, $1,000 is a lot of money." And the fact that you're already paying way more than $1,000 right now.
I wouldn't regard $1,000 to be a lot of money for this. I mean, or to tell lawyers if they were helping you estate plan, which, you know, and figure out your trust situation, all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, they've got expertise and some effort is required. I mean, it's $1,000 on the base of however much it is, but the base is seven figures. So, you know, it's anyway.
Yeah. So much for that.
But I mean, I was just thinking an interesting economics question is, what is it about particular products and particular industries that lead to the hidden fee thing versus the more explicit fee, the form of the contract, the nature of the sort of transparency and stuff like that? I don't know what that is, but, you know. Anyway, we were going to talk about something else.
But it's certainly by the information asymmetry and the complexity of it is certainly a key part of that. And this, the fact that it's also been presented to us in a way, you made a lot of your investments through your employer. You never really, it was never a market where you really went out as an individual and did anything. You were.
And by the way, as you know, these employer-based benefits are also hidden fees. It's implicit in the wage. I mean, you know, the employer is paying for the healthcare, quote unquote, only in the sense that when he hires you, he's paying you a wage and he knows he's paying the healthcare. What do you think your wage would be if he didn't have to pay the healthcare? Certainly not lower.
That you're welcome to my world. You know, if you think about the debate over the Cadillac tax and things like that, it's really can we handle a policy conversation where we make these things more transparent? But I would say one final thing, and then we should shift, which is I'm very interested in how black-white disparities and other kinds of disparities sort of are intertwined with some of these issues about the behavioral economics of saving and advising. And when I talk to my young African-American friends about how they should get themselves started, they face some dilemmas that I don't face. And things like, you know, am I ready to buy a house? Turns out to be a really interesting and deep conversation. And with my students and the way that money interacts with people's human relationships in a complicated way, I can't tell you how many of my students will say something like, "I've been living with my partner for 2 months. We have each other's Facebook passwords. We've never looked at each other's credit card bills. You know, we don't know each other well enough for that." And, you know, that's it. And we all know, you know, money is just very intimate.
You're raising a lot of deep issues because what is intimacy and how much does intimacy extend to financial information sharing, which presumably has something to do with the hazard rate on the termination of the relationship. You know what I mean? If it's half-life, then you're probably more interested in binding kind of things and you'd be more willing to share information. But on this wealth point, and the racial difference, I mean, that, of course, is a major vehicle by which the structural racism argument proceeding from journalists like Ta-Nehisi Coates and academics on campuses around the country, this has become all the rage.
Yeah.
And it's going to be observed that black wealth is lower. Darity, I had him on the program recently at Duke.
I watched it. I like him a lot.
There's a guy called Tom Shapiro, who's a sociologist. I think he's at NYU.
Yeah.
Had a book out with Mel Oliver long ago that became very fabled in this respect. It's at the root of the reparations argument. The reparations argument is substantially buttressed to the extent that it can be buttressed. We could have an argument about reparations, but that not for this day. I just say wealth disparities. And so the way it's made real, the way that the, quote, plunder of the black population from slavery and so forth, the fact that Reconstruction did not involve a fundamental land reform in which the plantations were turned over as a, you know, many of the commentators, Thaddeus Stevens or somebody like that would have won, is...
When affirmative action was white would be in the conversation.
Okay, so that, yeah. Although I think it's complicated. I mean, I appreciate Katz Nelson, our Katz Nelson historian and Columbia political scientist, point about the bias. You know, it was a conservative Southern Democratic majority that FDR was working with. They didn't want their entire institutional framework upset, and so there's bias built in. On the other hand, you have to say the blacks were helped by the New Deal. I mean, you know, they weren't hurt by the New Deal.
Okay? They were helped, but they were helped less than they should have been, et cetera.
And therefore, the cumulative effect of this comes down when you're trying to buy a house and the kid is 23 years old, and one set of kids has parents that can write a $50,000 check, and the other set of kids doesn't have those kind of parents, and then, you know, everything is thrown a kilter. And what I want to ask you, basically, is that racism? Is it remediable? Should it be remediated? Is it rightly thought of in racial terms? What do we want to say about it? What do we want to say about the fact that, you know, land tenure, if you looked at land tenure, you'd probably find, you know, black peasants didn't get the right kind of access or whatever. You could also do implicit stuff like people didn't have representation. It was governance without representation. They didn't have a vote. So in effect, they're being extracted from, they're being appropriated. I mean, there's no limit, it seems to me, to the ways in which you can do this. And
what interests me about, I mean, some other day we really should have a more, a deep conversation about this. But what interests me is sort of the optimal behavior of individuals in the environment in which they find themselves, and how. So, for one of the reasons why, so I tell a lot of my young friends, especially if they don't have kids, I say, you know, why don't you put your money in an index fund? First of all, everybody should be investing in index funds. But secondly, you know, you're going to pay the same price as everybody else, and you're not going to be embedded within an entire structure of transactions where you might be at a disadvantage. In the housing market, and also where you might not, because you don't have as much wealth as some of your counterparts might have, the leveraging of putting down a huge chunk of your wealth in a house is more risky for you. And also there's just the reality that a lot of the relationships, that there's a difference in the divorce rate, for example, between blacks and whites. And if you plunk all your money into a house and then something happens to your job or your relationship, financially it's devastating. There are ways in which this history and sort of the reality of the sociology of American life as it often shows up in race affects the decision making.
There's no doubt of that, but you know, not but. I mean, affirming everything that you just said, very interesting. Still, I want to say, you know, like you say, divorce rate differences, and of course, these things are all connected. On the other hand, as between various populations, I don't know, a largely Catholic Mexican immigrant population, a largely highly literate and professionalized Jewish middle, upper middle class population, an inner city African American population in an industrial, declining big city in the United States, there will be different divorce rates. Different rates of out-of-wedlock birth, different rates of cohabitation, different rates of homosexuality, different rates of a whole lot of other expressions. I'm sorry, I don't mean to equate homosexuality with any other pathology.
But it's socially
I'm not saying any of these things are pathologies. Different patterns of behavioral expression. But we are reluctant to allow that there might be different cultural norms, that there might actually be differences in the collective and affirmed, enforced, and believed in sets of values of what constitutes honor, of what is a life well lived. These communities may be different in some way. Now, if I observe these historical patterns, and I know that there's been wealth appropriation disadvantageous to the African-American population, and I disallow a priori, and, you know, of course, I went into that cultural observation because we all know that it's not permissible within polite discourse, within academic discourse, within public accounts. I mean, I saw something amazing here, and I know I'm rambling a little bit, but I'll get to my point. I saw Bernie Sanders chastised in Ceylon by Joan Walsh for saying in the debate with Hillary Clinton that his broad-based social democratic program would reduce incarceration rates and other kinds of things because when people had jobs, there would be less criminal behavior or something like that, okay? And he was chastised for suggesting that somehow it was criminal behavior among blacks, bad behavior among them, which would be diminished by his program, which was going to get him in trouble. The title of the piece was Bernie Sanders Has an Obama Problem. Okay? Mm-hmm. And it was going to get him in trouble because he had dared make reference to some differences in behavioral patterns linked to race, which were going to be ameliorated by his public policies. And I thought, that's astounding. You mean to tell me you can't observe? I mean, this is not just don't talk about black on black murder when you discuss the value of a black life in an urban environment. Don't talk about this. Is not just that taboo. This is a more profound kind of because that's a discursive taboo. That's we won't go there. We won't discuss it. This is an epistemic taboo. This is a kind of I refuse to acknowledge a kind of causality or a kind of social reality that's actually relevant to my problem. Okay, I've gone on for a while. You see what I'm getting at?
I do. Well, let me get to Sanders in a minute because I think we want to talk about Sanders distinctively. There's a bunch of things we can talk about with Sanders. But let's come back to the cultural issues and how it relates to some of these financial things. So I think there are different cultural patterns. And so one of the biggest things is that especially for people who are, say, the first person in their family to go to college, buying a home is really a badge of honor. And it's really a sign of upward mobility and adulthood for a lot of us. In fact, that's true for all of us, but it certainly has a special meaning if you are, say, your family is from the south side of Chicago and you've gotten a job as a teacher and now you're living in Homewood Flossmoor in Chicago and you're thinking about buying a house. And that's really like you've done good, you know, that's deep for everybody. And I think there's nothing pathological about any aspect of this conversation. But then you sort of have the conversation, you think, well, this house that you're thinking about buying is 250 grand and you're earning 80 grand a year right now. And let's walk through the blocking and tackling of how that's going to be successful for you. And there's no question of no one's behaving pathologically in any way, but there's a question of prudence. And these cultural values and signifiers and family connections really matter because so I buy this house, I have a good financial plan, but now I'm the person in my family who owns the home, who lives in Homewood, and who people can turn to as the source of support when something bad happens to them. And I'm able to pay my mortgage and everything, but I don't have a whole lot of extra going. And all of a sudden, people look to me who are close to me for help because they really have something that they need help for. And there's no villain in the story, but I'm entangled in a social network where other people might have to call on me for resources, and my wealth is in my house. And is that good or bad? It's good in one way that if it were in my 401k, it would be a little bit too easy for me to borrow from that 401k and start doing things that maybe not in my long-term interest. But, you know, these cultural things get so – they're so radioactive because we talk about them in connection to these, you know, to crime and to these differences in performance and sort of worthy behaviors. But they show up in everything. They show up in how people are trying to save for their retirement. They show up in what people eat, and they show up in so many ways that we want to be. We want to honor and embrace our culture, but we also want to be careful in that it frames the way that we think about our choices. Sometimes in a way that puts us at risk. And, you know, one of the challenges, I interviewed a retired football player, Dante Stallworth, and I was talking to him about how he managed his money. And a lot of athletes love to put their money into like a restaurant because it's like I can touch it. Yeah. You know, And the idea, like I would invest in that fund, you know,
and they can catch some cachet on their public name and so forth.
But it's also just this idea that Vinny it's tangible.
So I
think these cultural things are interesting and deep.
I want to ask another kind of question. Okay. I mean, and I hear you. Mm-hmm. Culture matters for behavior. These are deep things. It varies, affected by history.
Mm-hmm.
Do we, as it were, hold people responsible for their cultures or harmless from them? Now, I'm drawing a contrast, and here's what I mean. Say I had a behavior like overeating, eating fried food, smoking, which was associated with cardiovascular disease or diabetes or something like that. And say I had health disparities and higher mortality and morbidity in a population, African-American population.
I ate at a Jewish deli last night, by the way, where I assure you we honored that high-fat tradition.
All right. So we got cultural variation. It affects diet. It affects mortality and morbidity. Okay. So now I come down to assessing health disparities. And let's suppose it exists. Let's suppose there's a difference in life expectancy. Somebody stands up and they cite the difference in life expectancy.
Yeah.
Am I permitted to, should I want to, make a correction before any inference about the disparity having some implication for racism, of adjusting the disparity for the observable differences in the health-related behaviors in the population? To do the adjustment would be to hold people responsible for the different patterns of behavior. To not do the adjustment would be to hold them harmless in the sense of assessing whether they needed some remedy for the fact that they had the disparity. It would be to hold them harmless. So what should we do, Harold?
I think the answer is a little bit particular. I certainly think, by the way, that we need to have a transparent conversation, because if in fact, like one of the things I love about Barack Obama is that he's very health conscious. And I remember during the 2008 campaign, Maureen Dowd was making fun of him because he wasn't eating a Philadelphia cheesesteak and therefore was not an authentic whatever, you know, in that stupid way that campaign coverage
do you
goes.
You see how much grease is dripping off of that cheesesteak?
Yeah.
Did you see the way they just cooked it right there on top of that thing?
yeah, that's right. And here he is, you know, a 47-year-old African-American man who's like not hypertensive. And I'm like,
okay, so Obama's a good model, but I think you're dodging my question because it was a philosophical question.
I think that some of these behaviors are so endogenous to the disadvantage that people have that at least has to be part of the conversation. But I certainly think whether you hold people harmless or not in some sort of statistical analysis of discrimination, I think it's incredibly important that we not have conversational taboos about the causal pathway. And it, because we can do something about the causal pathway. I mean, suppose we say that differences in HIV transmission are totally rooted in historical disadvantage. And we had a bunch of convincing stories that explained why that was so. We still want to get out to people, you know what, there's a risk of HIV, and here's what you need to do to protect yourself and the people around you. And, you know, if somebody, like when I did public health work, I always thought there were two kinds of people that one would talk to in inner city minority communities. There's the person who says, I think the CIA created AIDS in 1965. And so now we all have to do what we have to do for public health, sort of the Reverend Wright type folk. And then there's the person who's like, Jewish doctors are spreading AIDS. Right, there's a third kind of person, which is the person that is more hip to the public health message as well as any of this stuff. But the distinction between the sort of Reverend Wrights of the world and the Louis Farrakhans of the world is actually quite important, that there's a lot of people who say, I want you to acknowledge the historical disadvantage, the importance of it, and the need to address those historical disadvantages in all sorts of ways, but I also want to get the work done right now in whatever way is most pragmatically helpful to reduce that disparity. And that person, I want to deal with.
So we do have discursive taboos, and for my money, the taboo that says you can't talk about black-on-black homicide, I just use this vernacular term, we both understand it's much more complicated than that. You can't do that because that's a diversion from talking about state-sanctioned violence against black bodies, is a kind of discursive taboo, and it does get in the way of causal understanding if I take to be the object of that understanding, the valuation and threats to the integrity of the black body. I mean, it's a rhetorical move. Pardon?
How much is that taboo real, and how much of that is greatly exaggerated? I mean, I see a lot of conservative conversation where
context,
nobody can talk about black on
in
black
the context
crime,
of,
and I hear a lot about black and black
excuse
crime.
Excuse me, in the context of the discussion of the role of the police, the taboo exists. I understand that there are responses on many fronts in communities, including the African-American community, to the traumatic things that happen in their midst. If people are being buried, this is just fundamental sociology, Durkheim or something, a whole elaborate structure of belief and mythic identification is going to be built up around it, including fervent expressions of the valuation of the life of this son's whose mother sits grieving over the dead body and so forth and so on. Of course, you would be denying the humanity of black people if you didn't know that such endogenous, I mean, intrinsic, you know, deeply rooted expressions of the valuation of the lives of these victims would be expressed. So I'm not denying that in the least, not in the least, not in the least, not in the least. Mm-hmm. However, governing an American city today in which violence is a fundamental element of life there requires the engagement of the police with communities of color, which are disadvantaged, in which there is high rates of criminal participation, high rates of violence, high levels of weapons, and so forth. So in that context, that's the context that I'm talking about. That's the one that the President of the United States and the Attorney General of the United States have had to address their attention to, yeah. That a national movement that people are likening to the movements of the 1950s and 60s has arisen, that presidential candidates have had to tailor and alter the way in which they address these issues and so forth and so on. We could go on for a long time about this. It's in that context that the discursive taboo on recognizing, and I'm going beyond, as it were, black-on-black homicide rates to talk about the reality of the level of criminal activity, the level of violence, the character of the threat, the nature of life on the streets in these communities, the communities where poor black people live, the communities where the heroes, everyone from Tamir Rice to the surviving relatives of Eric Garner, who are now participants in the presidential campaign discourse, reside in those communities, the communities that working class white cops from places like Staten Island and Cicero, Illinois, have to go and risk their lives in those communities where those very same cops are despised by people who now in their routine persecution of their duties will find themselves surrounded by mobs with cell phones. In those communities, the discursive taboo, which prevents a realistic assessment of what the maintenance of order would actually mean, which would have to be, you know, secured by the officers of the public trust, a realistic assessment is obscured. The causal mechanisms are not identified because we have a discursive taboo. And if you were to mention it in the context of Freddie Gray, in the context of Michael Brown, or even in the context of Trayvon Martin, if you were to mention it, you would be driven from public discourse. You would be prevented from speaking on an elite college campus. Your piece would not get published in the New York Times, Harold. Well, that's what I'm talking about. Thank you for allowing me to say it.
Well, by the way, I would say your friend John McWhorter has been writing in the New York Times. There's a lot of people writing in a lot of places.
Okay,
it's not exactly clear.
Don't nitpick me,
how
man. Address my argument. I overstepped. I agree. Okay.
There. Well, let me say a couple things. I think you're right that within the African American community, that there is such a focus on excessive force and misbehavior by police and over incarceration that does constrain some of the conversations that we need to have about ways that we need to reduce the violence. The way that has shown up in my own life is that I very much would like to see more focused deterrence around guys who are caught carrying guns. I mean, guns are basically the vector through which the deaths are occurring. A couple of young guys get into it. One of them has a gun, and then we have a dead body. And if there's no gun, there's no dead body. And these young guys are walking around with guns because they're scared of each other, and then they get into it because some guy looks at their girlfriend. And there's this, and we can tell. And I thought Ta-Nehisi told that story actually pretty well in Between the World and Me about, you could tell it. You could obviously, a game theoretic explanation is pretty obvious about how they're stuck in this equilibrium that we're trying to get out of. When I go and talk to people in the South Side of Chicago, and I say, you know, we really have to have a more focused deterrence message around the guys who are caught with an illegal gun. It's a very difficult conversation for me to make much headway on, because people are so upset about over-incarceration and the drug war, and because the same people who want to see more stringent gun stuff are often the people who are seen as people who are closing schools and not dealing with the social needs of the community. And there's not a lot of oxygen for a conversation about moving this aspect of policing in a more aggressive direction. And I think that the way that you have to deal with those taboos, I think, is by actually having legitimacy and relationships within that community and then doing it. You are right that there are some aspects of the problem that right now we have to find a better way to talk about. And I think, I can tell you, I'll get another Ta-Nehisi story since he comes up a lot on this. He came up to visit me when he was writing the reparations article, and we went out to dinner with a bunch of CPD brass and policymakers, and we were talking about the gun issue and how so many of the guys that are arrested in gun stuff have serious rap sheets and how it's a real problem. And I think that, we had a good conversation. And then Ta-Nehisi goes out the next day and he's researching the piece, and he's harassed by the Chicago Police Department with his friends. And he goes back to Washington. He writes, I had a dinner with people and I sort of, the wine was flowing. It was a good conversation.
Let's talk about that for a minute. I'm cutting you off. Go ahead.
He was basically saying thank you to the Chicago Police Department for reminding me of some basic realities about who I would have to trust if we went, if we had more aggressive policies.
It should be bigger than that is what I want to say. And it's a hard point. His duty is to rise above it. And not be driven by that experience. But I mean, that's a heavy lift. Okay. I understand that. And so you can't begrudge somebody that they didn't do it, but that's the point, that's the position that I want to stake out.
But shall we shift over to talk about,
we weren't finished talking about this. I mean, I'm interested in the problem. I'm interested in the problem of stereotypes and statistical discrimination and the ethics of it. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happens is, you're going to get, quote, harassed by police, quote, if you look like somebody who they think might be an offender. Ta-Nehisi is black. He's relatively young. He's of a body size and so forth like that, that he might be mistaken for, quote, a thug, close quote, or whatever. OK, so it's going to happen. I mean, I didn't like it when I was asked to present my ID when I was trying to get into the English department building to hear a lecture. And I thought that, first of all, I'm a professor. Secondly, I thought they should be honored that an economist wanted to come to the English department. And they wouldn't let me in without showing an ID because it was after hours and they have a security thing. But I'm saying to myself, if I had been a white kid or even a white guy looking like this age, they wouldn't have asked me for my ID. But because I live in Providence, Rhode Island, and townspeople might wander up the hill, and because there have been incidents, right, where kids' cell phone is taken and whatever. So Brown has deployed security officers who stand on the corners. They're unarmed, but they're just visible presences in the byways into the night here in order to maintain a certain kind of environment. Anyway, what I want to say is, if I'm writing about the relationship, I'm an intellectual now, between the community and the police, and I experience the offense on the downside of a predictable consequence of the disparity in the offending rates by race or the high level of offending in a particular environment. Now, if a bad cop is just running around trying to find a black person arbitrarily in order to perpetrate some offense against them, obviously that person needs to be dealt with. But if somebody's on the streets of Hyde Park or someplace else and it's a mixed population and there are incidents, this kind of thing is predictably going to happen.
But it's also, isn't it predictable? So I'm on this, I'm working with a group that's trying to sort of deal with some of the policing issues we have in Chicago. And so I've been marinating in things like the collective bargaining agreements that the police have.
And
almost every case where someone presents a complaint against police, the procedures are set up in such a way that the officer has a tremendous advantage in the way that that is pursued internally, and where in reality, almost all, some of the statistics on the number of cases, the percentage of cases that are decided in favor of the officer, it's just amazing. And especially in cases where we know that where we have video of police behaving egregiously and there's no accountability for it, it's not surprising that that there's this tremendous community backlash, because so many of the young people that I speak to have very specific experiences where they have been mistreated.
Denying that. I'm not denying that. The question is, how are we going to police the city? Okay,
I don't think it's correct to say
that people haven't been held accountable. People haven't been convicted. Darren Wilson was held accountable for Michael Brown's death. He wasn't convicted.
Well, but
in the Eric Garner situation were held accountable. They were tried. They were put at risk of loss of their liberty. A jury of their peers declined to convict them.
Can I just make
this point, though?
Yeah. Go ahead.
The idea that the situation is one of a massive imposition upon African-American personhood of unaccountable violence from the state is false. That's what I'm saying. It is not a realistic characterization. The idea that I might be stopped and asked to produce my ID or in some other way harassed, as I was in New York City riding on a bicycle when I was accosted by police officers for the crime of riding my bicycle on the sidewalk. That fact, it happened to me, it happens to people every day. Anyone can tell these stories.
Yeah.
Does not constitute a demonstration of the normative claim that the forces of the state infringe upon the liberty of African Americans in such a way that we have a major political issue on our hands. The political issue that we have, if we have one, is the unequal protection deriving from the state's monopoly on the legitimate use of force enjoyed by the residents of high crime districts in our cities. We have a very serious problem here, okay?
So getting it wrong,
I don't care about somebody's story about harassment. I don't believe that it rises to the level, as I say. It's rhetorical, it's dramatic, it's remonstrative, it's moral manipulation. It's a shell game, Harold. That's the position I'm staking out. Black Lives Matter indictment of the police of this country is a rhetorical move that illustrates the amazing leverage that ideas can have over our ability to comprehend the reality in which we're embedded. That's my position.
Well, I guess I agree with aspects of your position and I disagree with others. I certainly agree that the disparities in violence require effective policing in low-income Black communities where people are being murdered and where life is unsafe. And we have to create a situation where police are effective at that and where they have the legitimacy in the community to do that job. I think, though, there's a couple of things. One is the number of stories that I've heard from young people where they get stopped. A 17-year-old kid gets stopped. Cop believes that this kid's dirty, but there's nothing on him. And he says, you know what, if you're not in a gang, then you won't have any problem if I drive you 2 miles across the gang boundary and handcuff you to this bench and just go out and get a cup of coffee and come back.
You're kidding me.
Stories like that. I'm going to drive you across the boundary and just drop you off and you're going to figure out a way to get home. Or stories of casual disrespect that people have. They're common. And I think that I think everybody across urban America was caught by surprise by the Black Lives Matter thing in a certain way. I've been in a lot of rooms where people talk about law enforcement, and I've always heard from police, we have to get along really well with the citizens of Englewood because, among other things, they have to tell us who has committed the crimes. We need pragmatic cooperation from people in these communities to keep them safe. But among the real serious urban politicians, the politics of policing has really always pivoted around two things. There's mobile people who, if they are scared, are going to leave the city. So there's people who live in Lincoln Park in Chicago who could move to Evanston or who could move to Flossmoor.
Okay, and who pay taxes and so forth.
And there's the Paul Peterson realities of city limits. And there's the police union, which is a very big political player.
Yeah.
And and we have to make sure that they are happy, among other things, because if they are unhappy, then they will not be affected. The idea that the police department is specifically politically accountable to the residents of these low-income, high-crime communities is actually a kind of new thing. And the idea that if the people in the South Bronx basically are just not happy with the way we do our jobs, that I could get fired, that's not the vibe that 5 years ago you would have heard.
Okay.
You would have, and I think that Black Lives Matter. So go ahead.
Yeah, I know we want to move on. Let me, in view of your generosity in conceding that there was some merit to the concerns that I had about public safety and so forth, but nevertheless, wanting to emphasize that the reality within these police departments, many of them in the practices and so forth and so on, and then the politics behind that will leave Black people feeling powerless against this force. I want to concede the legitimacy of that. Police unions, prison guard unions too, for that matter, and in a different venue. And this yuppie, we would have called them in years gone by, class of people who want to redo buildings and put track lighting in and hardwood floors and stuff. And revitalize restaurants up and down the avenue and whatnot, and you don't want to lose that. Not being responsible. Okay, so I mean, I'll take all that, and you know, it's complicated, and it's a pretty interesting story. But we're talking about Black Lives Matter. We're talking about a movement, and we're intellectuals, and we're also talking about discursive taboos. And I want to mention, if I may, the case of Imani Perry. Did you see this? Professor Imani Perry of African American Studies at Princeton.
I don't
Princeton.
Know the details of it. I know she was stopped by police.
She was stopped by police, and it was in the New York Times. It was a story in the New York Times. She made a big deal out of it. She went on Twitter and Facebook, and there were many likes and shares, and people commenting as they will on the social media about how awful it was that she claimed to have been poorly treated by the Princeton Police Department, having been arrested merely for a parking ticket, and then having been touched by a male officer who was having been handcuffed to a bench when she was in custody because she was taken into custody. And it was all about a parking ticket from 3 years ago. And the fact, as reported in the New York Times and as recounted by the Princeton police, although at one point on Twitter I saw that she was saying that the Princeton police chief was lying, and I therefore don't know, but I can tell you it was reported in the New York Times. She was stopped for driving 47 in a 25-mile zone. She was on a license that had been suspended in 2013, so she was driving without a license. And indeed, a warrant had been issued for her arrest in virtue of her neglect of the parking tickets from some previous period.
The police had a case.
There was a webcam, a dashboard cam. The police chief said he saw nothing unusual. He said they don't have a protocol about men touching women that sometimes has to be done because they don't have enough female officers, although he was willing to look into whether or not it was appropriate in this case. It's a protocol to secure the suspect in the police station when they take the person in before they're whatever. She wasn't permitted to make a call. She complained with her telephone to let people know where she was going to be because she was going to be taken into custody. And she didn't want to end up like Sandra Bland. Okay, this is a professor at Princeton, okay, who fears that the Princeton Township Police are going to abuse her, but complains because the protocol is once you've been booked at the station, then you can make your call. Okay, so all of this, I know these facts. Okay, now how do I know them? Because she made a federal case out of this. Now, with respect to Professor Imani Perry and the powerful feelings that she must have from having had that experience, I too have been taken into custody by police officers. It's very unpleasant. But I have to tell you, Harold, if I were driving knowingly on a 3-year-old suspended license at nearly twice the speed limit and I got pulled over, I would expect to be taken into custody, Harold. I would expect to be taken into custody. There's a warrant for my arrest. I'm driving at almost twice the speed limit. My license has been suspended for 3 years. Come on. Not taking a person, any person of any color and any rank, into custody under those circumstances would be to give them a pass. Okay? Now, he could have done it. He could have given her a pass. He could have said, you work for Princeton. Oh, I tell you, madam, you got to promise me. You got to promise. You know, he could have done that. He didn't. Yeah. He could have done that. He didn't. Okay? Is his election to not do that an indication of the awesome power of the American state's unaccountable policing? It is not, Harold. No, plainly, the evocation by this woman, Imani Perry, of Sandra Bland is a crime against our collective consciousness and awareness of the reality of our lives. It's a manipulative appropriation, okay? It's the deployment of a symbol on behalf of the pettiest personal motive, okay? It's wrong, Harold. It needs to be denounced and called out. Black women in Princeton are not subject to the rogue authority of police officers. And the fact that this woman, who happens to be a professor at Princeton, is able to make her negligence and inattention to her civic obligations, renew your license, pay your fine, into an instance of an affront against Black people, I deeply and profoundly resent it. Get your hands off of the collective reputation and the moral integrity of my people. You don't act as a Black person when you do that. You act as a selfish little brat when you do that. That's right. You heard it here. I mean, I'm sorry if I put you at a disadvantage because you haven't followed the case closely, and there's no reason for you to have an opinion, and certainly I'm not asking you to affirm my opinion. I'm willing to go out on that limb all by myself.
Fair enough. Let me say that there's certainly, it sounds like the police have a case in this, and the police often, and all of these cases, many of these cases, there's a level of ambiguity, and there's a level of just what happened that needs to be respected. And one of the striking things about these video cam things, of course, is they bring out how often, like in the shooting in Chicago, where all the officers except one are doing exactly the right thing. This one officer drives up, kills the kid, and then all the officers who are doing the right thing, nonetheless,
they support it.
But it's on both sides that, you know, the Michael Brown case, there was substantial evidence that was exculpatory for the officer in that incident. So it's certainly every case needs to be. Nobody's a stage extra who's just there, that everybody's got a story that actually has to be.
That I said there was reported in the New York Times. That's all I can tell you. I just told you what I learned from reading the New York Times.
But we don't have all that much time.
We don't have that much time. I'm sorry. We did want to talk about Bernie Sanders and Michelle Alexander's article in The Nation. Is that what we wanted to talk about, or did we? I mean, if we didn't want to talk about that, I'm okay with that. More discursive taboos at work, but the Black vote, South Carolina primary coming, this kind of thing.
Well, I could say a couple of things. I'm actually heartened that the Black vote is so pivotal in the Democratic primary. I mean, the African-American community actually has real power. Nobody's patting the Black community on the head on this. This is really... I mean, the African-Americans in South Carolina and other places are going to play a huge role in who's going to be the next president of the United States, and everybody knows that. And, you know, you watch Sanders and Clinton debate, and they're basically speaking straight to the Black and Hispanic communities that are so critical in the Democratic Party. And I think that's actually a great thing. You know, this is actual power. This is not this matters.
Yes, sir.
And it's that's one thing. I must say I'm not feeling the burn on this. And I think,
are you making a declaration here? You're endorsing Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, and she's an imperfect person in a lot of ways. But I think the Black community will rescue her nomination because
at least
I think
you
that
hope so. Yeah.
Well, I think that I think one thing about most, you know, the African American community as a whole, not obviously everyone, is I think that people are very focused on, it's really important to win the 2016 election. We got to, you know, in South Carolina, for example, we want to somehow figure out a way to help people get Medicaid and deal with the fundamental problems that people have who need help from the government.
Wait a minute. Nikki Haley is the governor of South Carolina. I don't anticipate that there's going to be a Democratic governor there anytime soon. But I take your point.
I mean, it is not an aspirational exercise. It is an exercise. It's a pragmatic exercise.
Okay.
And I remember when I was working in Flint in the year 2000, my African-American colleagues were puzzled by the Nader phenomenon. And they sort of thought, is he a Republican? I remember people would say, is he a Republican agent or something like that? Because because he's obviously going to throw the election to Bush.
Yeah.
You know, And he did. And I think that there is the idea of sort of – a campaign where the Sanders, I like Bernie Sanders. I think he's a very decent person running a classy campaign. I don't see the roadmap to go from here to there on almost any of the issues that he's talking about. You know, whether it's mass incarceration, except for on the issue of Wall Street, there's a lack of substance, or at least a lack of sort of detail and sort of the kinds of things that you and I as policy wonks want to see. That makes it that, like an eight, like their healthcare plan is like an 8-page thing.
Yeah, I know. And you have a beautiful piece on why it is not so easy to get from here to there on single payer. But I just want to, I want to talk about Wall Street for a minute, because this circles back to an earlier part in our conversation when we were doing the finance thing. Now it's big finance, not personal finance. But I have to just tell you, I'm going to confess this to anybody who can hear me. As an economist, I shudder at the prospect that the rage that's fueling Bernard Sanders would get their hands on the financial services industry. I just have to tell you, I don't know. Just let me finish, okay? I want to be clear that I'm not against the value of getting some money out of the accounts of the fat cats and putting it to some other purpose. I'm saying the financial services industry in a global financial system, not only its importance to the oiling the gears of the American economy, but just as a service, it's a global business. It's huge, okay? Now, speculation tax. Every trade is some kind of evil thing that we need to be afraid of. Come on. That's just like hackery. That can't be a serious assessment.
Well, the Tobin tax is...
Of the incidents of the kinds of taxation things that that he wants to do. And breaking up the banks, it seems to me, and again, I'm not an expert, but maybe you are, not a lot easier. I'm just telling you the shudder that this rhetoric gives me if I contemplate that would actually come to pass. people are going to get mad at me for saying this. It's kind of like there's a goose laying something of a golden egg here. I get it about 2008. I get it about over-leveraging. I get it about complex instruments. I get it about non-transparency. I get it about rating agencies.
There's a long list of stuff that you're getting there, Glenn. It's starting to add up. Go ahead.
Does it add up to some kind of, quote, speculation tax on every transaction that's enacted on an exchange? And this suspicion that these guys, I'm going to be saying what Hillary Clinton probably would say if she could say it, the suspicion that this industry is peopled by these nefarious bloodsuckers. I'll just take my apostasy one step further and give you a chance to rebut me fully. The top 1% got this much of the economy's growth. Okay? It's a ludicrous, manipulative way of talking. As if when I see the economy go, that increment was some public thing to which everybody is, you know, having access at differential weights. It got produced, Harold.
Well,
let me just finish the point. Okay. The point is, how did it get produced? And does the fruit of that labor belong to the people who provided it? So if you want to redistribute wealth, then go ahead and redistribute wealth. I'm taking your money and I'm giving it to somebody else. But the idea, this backdoor argument, it was everybody's money and you got an unfair share of it. Where did it come from?
Well, I think that there's a couple of things that go on, some of which are in the "I get this" when you gave your list. I mean, you have this sector where there's a huge amount of rent seeking, where there's a huge amount of public sector backstopping of risk, which is assumed in these complex transactions that you're describing, where the social benefit of a lot of what's happening is difficult to specify. I mean, I don't see a lot of people saying, you know, it's really horrible that Steve Jobs and Bill Gates have such ridiculous amounts of money, because there's some sense, you know, you make an iPhone and you sell it and people buy it and you end up with a huge amount of money. That's the way capitalism is supposed to work. An awful lot of what's happened in the financial sector has harmed the broader economy in various ways, imposed all sorts of externalities. And the power of this sector, because of rising inequality, their ability to influence the political system.
Oh, that's another point. That's a separate point. But okay.
So there's a lot, and the idea that a Tobin transaction tax or something might be helpful is at least worth considering, in my view, because especially if you come back to the beginning of the conversation, a ton of what the sector is doing You know, is it's very debatable that it's creating social value. Certainly,
okay, so,
to regulate you know, the personal finance industry in a fundamentally more stringent way, which they're fighting, you know, very, very fiercely. You know, there's a lot there that where they need to be curbed.
We're dealing here with the intellectual fallout of 2008, 2007, and 2008, I think, and yeah. The discrediting not only of the financial services industry, especially at the top and in the big banks, but also of the intellectual, the economics, finance theories of the Robert Mertens and the Eugene Fama's and all these other people besides. And we're in the behavioral economics nudge world of pools of money that people, because they know the tricks of the game, are able to get access to, which should be sucked up and made available to the public and so on and so on. I accept that. But mm-hmm. I accept that is that we're in that environment. Okay. I don't necessarily accept the characterization of the industry or of the activities that are undertaken there. So, for example,
let me just add one more group that's been discredited, which is the group of politicians who I often agree with, actually, on a lot of policy issues, but who are very closely identified with the financial industry and who basically took the perspective that the financial industry should be pretty much deregulated in a lot of
instances. Yeah, they have definitely been discredited. There's no doubt about the repeal of Glass-Steagall and all of that.
And
Elizabeth Warren is riding high. I get it. And Hillary Rodham Clinton is implicated, and Lawrence Summers is implicated, and so on and so forth. I get it. I agree that they are discredited. I don't know that they are in every respect wrong. Okay, so here, I mean, I just want to try. This
Good
is the
point.
Economist. If you want to call me a neoliberal, then go ahead and do it. But I'm just going to say the following thing. It's an illusion to think that if I can see the fruit of the product, like an iPhone that I hold in my hand, that's a greater production of value than if I can't see the fruit of the product because it's embedded in the profits made by a securities trade. That's an illusion. The securities trade's profit is also socially productive, although it doesn't have a real, in the terms of physical connection, relationship to productivity. To wit, everyone has seen The Big Short. The guy that took the other side of the market and who leveraged himself into billionaire status did a public service, okay? Calling up and bursting the bubble and forcing the confrontation with the House of Cards thing was a public service. And the fruits that he took out there, arbitrage, let me just go further. That's very vivid. Arbitrage,
that's
me seeing an opportunity. There's something that is selling high over here and that is trading low over there. And I went and got it, found it. Maybe I never got up from my keyboard, moved it. Maybe no pieces of paper exchanged hands. And the prices move toward equality. That's public service. There's social surplus underneath the demand and the supply curves that have been brought into closer equilibrium by that activity. It's just an illusion to assert that financial services, because it does not involve manufacturing of goods, that they haven't done anything. And it's a slander, okay?
Well, let me question that.
It's demagoguery.
But you're right that there's certainly financial services that are valuable, and we want prices to stay close to their fundamentals. And short sellers who observe that a particular company is drastically overvalued contribute to the economy.
That's what I'm talking about.
If somebody is figuring out, literally, if they can execute a trade 5 microseconds ahead of somebody else. A lot of this activity does not actually generate the kind of public information and movement to prices back to their fundamentals and that sort of thing that you're describing. And the very fact that the financial industry accounts for such a large fraction of total corporate profits in America is itself kind of an indictment of that sector, because what it's supposed to do is efficiently allocate capital. And ideally, it should be allocating capital at a fairly low cost to the rest of the economy. And the fact that over time this sector has grown so big and so profitable is kind of concerning, because
I'm not disagreeing with what you said, but I'm not agreeing with it either. I want to see the accounting that tells me what the right size of the financial sector share of profits. There could be a model. We're going to need, this is why economists exist in my mind. You need some kind of account of how the industry is functioning, what the role of finance is, how it relates to other activities in the economy, some kind of Tobin-esque Bob Solo-esque general equilibrium kind of confronting with the financial sector. Maybe it exists. I don't know. It's not my field of expertise. That would allow me to assess whether 18%, 30%, or 60% was the right number. I don't know how we know a priori that 30% is too big. I mean, and I don't mean to be making excuses for anybody. I'm just saying I'd want to look at it.
By the way, the fact that that tax that you describe, the speculative tax, the fact that it's known as the Tobin tax tells you something about what he thought.
We are speaking here, Blogging Heads audience, of the great late James Tobin, who was a Yale economics professor and who had a profound effect on macroeconomics. He was the leading or amongst the two or three leading post-Keynesian economists coming out of the 1930s and with a whole lot of stuff that we could, the Tobin's Q and all this kind of, we could go into it, but it would take us off of the beaten path.
I don't know, Harold. And friend of... And mentor of Harold Pollack, by the way.
Oh, I didn't know that, Harold.
And
lucky man! After you left the Kennedy School, and when you were at with Ted, somebody in Yale at the ISPS or whatever they call it.
But you know, I want to end on something more positive.
Okay, Harold. Because more positive than this argument about finance. Okay, go ahead.
Your friend and mine, Keith Humphreys, wrote a terrific article in the Washington Post.
Thank you for remembering that.
In Wonk Blog. Keith is a fantastic scholar and person. And
I agree on all fronts.
And where he noted that incarceration among African Americans is actually going down, and that black-white disparities, especially among women, have come down pretty strikingly. And, you know, it's odd that this doesn't get greater attention. And there's lots of complicated reasons why these disparities have narrowed, but it's a very interesting fact that just
people should go to the Washington Post blog and find this, or my Facebook page if you can get there. But I just put the graphs up on the Facebook thing, and they're very quite striking for the women. I mean, the line for white women, which is below the black women's line, is going up. The black women's line is coming down, and they're converging over this period of 20 years. Whereas for men, the white line is rising a bit, but the black line is coming down precipitously. So the gap, while still substantial, is nevertheless narrowing. These are the rates of persons in custody per 100,000 in the population that he's showing.
If you went to samefacts.com, by the way, you would also see Keith has a piece there.
There you are.
Which, by the way, you are now an occasional contributor to the reality-based community. So.
I am. I'm at reality-based community, and I'm at Heterodox Academy. Hey, you know about Heterodox Academy? This is Jonathan Haidt. And people are wondering, can I be at both sites? I see no inconsistency whatsoever between wanting there to be viewpoint diversity in the colleges and universities, on the one hand, and wanting to tether one's social observations to the evidence and realities in which we're embedded rather than some fanciful imagined world. On the other
I hope we can have a Blogheads conversation about that. I actually think that discrimination against conservatives in the academy is a real thing, even though it's often hyped, and that it does harm the academy. I also think some of that is conservatives' own fault, because on the merits, so many of the positions that they take are ridiculous, and the fact that the academy reject it. I mean, when you're on climate change and so on, is it really surprising that climate scientists are all liberal? I mean, you know, it's et cetera. So we could discuss
it's a subject another for another agent. Discussion. Even the climate thing we could talk about, Harold, since neither of us are experts, therefore it wouldn't be as touchy as the healthcare thing where you have the Trump cards on me. On the climate thing, I don't deny, please no one out there think that I do, that you know, there are climate issues and that there are human activity that needs to be considered in the context of that. But what to do, how to do it, how fast to do it, how much to spend, you know, how to think about it. I mean, it's, you know, there are religious things going on here. I mean, mysticism kind of things that are behind it. I love our planet. How are we supposed to feel about our planet, future generations? What am I, you know, there's just deep stuff. So, for example, modern technological civilization ultimately is on the table if you want to talk about climate change. I mean, if we wanted to ask ourselves deep questions about how we're living, I'd be more on it than if we're just playing some cheap partisan cards where I want the Keystone Pipeline, you don't want it, therefore you're not for the whatever, you know.
Well, I was just making a simpler point, which is there's that liberals are, like everybody else, a sociological community, and it's always concerning when, for reasons that are actually quite understandable and intellectually defensible, most economists are most academics are liberal.
Yes.
That has consequences for the way that we are able to have conversations. And one can believe that liberals are right about just about everything and believe
still
still be concerned about that. And that's,
okay, now so I got to ask you a very mischievous question, which, of course, you cannot answer because there's no time.
There you go.
Most academics are Jewish, too, as a matter of fact. Of course, that may be an exaggeration literally. But especially when you start getting into the rarefied precincts of sociology or economics, whatever like that, a lot of academics are Jewish. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's any relationship, and I ask this, I hope, without offending anybody, I just put a sociological question on the table, between the overrepresentation of Jews in the American Academy on the one hand and the political temper of the American academic climate on the other? If you regard that as a somehow inappropriate question, you should instruct me. But I don't give you the opportunity really to answer, though you should have an opportunity to respond to my intervention. That could be a question for another time as well.
Well, you know, I thought you were going to go into the Israel-Palestinian thing, so I had some relief that this wasn't.
No,
the,
that wasn't what I was thinking. I guess that's a sub theme within this line. No, I was thinking much more about the kind of intellectual structure of ideas. I mean. I find, you know, I'm writing this memoir, so I'm thinking about the early neocon years. You know, I knew Irving Kristol. I mean, I knew him, you know, cigarette smoking, a little short guy, very brilliant guy. He probably never sat and wrote anything more than 3,000 or 4,000 words, you know, because that, you know, but always a provocateur and whatnot. I knew his son, William Kristol, when he was an assistant professor at the Kennedy School in political philosophy and stuff like that. You know, I'm very much taken by, for example, the alcove culture. A lot of people love Bloomsbury. You know, they want to think about John Maynard Keynes wandering around in London. I want to think about these Jews and some others. There were some others. There were some Catholics, and there was the occasional Negro in the mix. But, you know, sitting around the alcove at the public university and, you know, arguing the Trotskyite argument and reading the literature and rereading Moby Dick and rethinking about the American experience and things like that. Impact of Jews in economics is astounding, man. I was making a list as I'm trying to write my memoir and think about my MIT days of all the people who influenced me, from Paul Samuelson to Peter Diamond to Peter Timmon Franklin Fisher to Stanley Fisher to Marty Weitzman to Robert Solow to I don't know if Franco Modigliani, the great Italian economist, the late great economist, was Jewish, but I bet my life on it.
The fact that I know this is itself hysterical.
Look at the Nobel Prizes. I could go on in my vein. If you were to look at the presidencies of the American political science, I mean, I haven't done it, but I'd bet a whole lot of money that there would be wildly overrepresentation of Jews in these various subsets of the academic thing. And so the notion that the culture, I mean, it would have to be looked into. I once read a great book by a guy called John Murray Cudahy called The Ordeal of Civility. It was the intellectual history of Marx, Freud, and Levi-Strauss. And the guy said, if you want to understand this tenure of this strand, I mean, think about this Marx, man. I mean, think about the huge impact that he had on political thought. Think about Freud and the huge impact that he had on the psyche and Levi-Strauss and anthropology and so on. He says, if you want to understand the development of these modernistic ideas in the mid, late 19th and early 20th century, you have to understand the ordeal of Jewish assimilation into Western European culture coming out of the shtetl in the East, in Germany, early in the 19th and late in the 18th century. And I never knew about it until I read this book.
Not to mention the murder of Jews in that same context also.
Pardon, say again?
Not to mention the murder of Jews in that same context also as a profound shadow over that same intellectual life.
That's true. Cudahy is only concerned with, you know, Levi-Strauss into the early 20th century, but you're right. I mean, yeah, indeed. Yeah. So I once read this very fine book by your colleague, at least it used to be your colleague, Peter Novick, historian at Chicago, called The Holocaust in American Life. And it's a history of this you know, idea about how we go off, we veer off into tangents here. But I mean, this power of the Jewish experience interacting with the American experience to color and affect the trajectory of ideas and you know, kind of
but
consensus
understandings. But I would add to that also the passing of that is also something that is very poignant. And because among people who are now 65, the story that you're telling is a much more compelling story than among the people who are now 32, for whom the Jewish presence in academia and the Jewish predicament is just fundamentally different.
Because of Israel?
Because of Israel, and also because of America, because Palestine. Jews have already assimilated. And you know, Jews who are now a 32-year-old Jewish professor at Harvard, of whom there are obviously quite many, that's a person who comes from, you know, a nice stereotypically speaking, is coming from a nice suburb in the United States, and it's just had a totally different experience from Kenneth Arrow and Paul Samuelson and all those people that were exiled from MIT to MIT because Harvard didn't like Jews.
You know, since we're still talking for the record, I have to say this, Harold. Ken Arrow came to my lecture. I gave a lecture here at the Center for Advanced Learning Behavioral Sciences on the challenges we confront for racial inequality into the 21st century. Ken Arrow is 93 years old, man.
I know.
He came up the hill here. I mean, he didn't walk up the hill.
That's good.
He was at my lecture, which was amazing, you know? I was so honored by that. But anyway, you're right. That's a very different experience. Stuff. And we should talk about that. This generation, man, Kenneth Arrow, when he published Social Choice and Individual Values in 1950, what was he, 24 years old or something ridiculous like that? Man, if you look at the impact of this guy's ideas in general equilibrium theory and dynamics and economics of uncertainty and contract theory.
He founded the field of
health economics. He wrote a fundamental article laying out all the principal agent dynamics that were ongoing there, man. A prodigious figure, you know. I mean, a really prodigious figure. And he came up out of that same mix that we were just describing.
But the world,
Columbia University, you know, yeah. Go ahead.
City College.
Where
my mother, by the way, is a graduate and was a Jewish radical who embodies some of that.
She's a wonderful woman.
Yeah, they're I would say absolutely. But I think the energy today is in you know, different groups of people and who are also having these profound experiences and it's very strange, by the way, being Jewish. And of course, I was raised on the iconography of a lot of the people that you just mentioned and the great scientists. We could tell the same. We could have the same conversation about all, you know, Richard Feynman and all these people.
Yeah.
The list is long. The current, you know, if you look today at the walk into the physics department at Stanford, of course, Asians and Asian Americans completely dominate.
Yes, sir. That's a good point. And their stories are going to be interesting ones to hear. You know, you'll be pleased to know my son Nehemiah was telling me about, surely you're joking, Mr. Feynman, which he's reading. It's on his nightstand, and he says it has him laughing and scratching his head and thinking about all these things. So, you know, God bless him, Richard Feynman, you know.
You know, I have to give a shout out to my father, who is still learning quantum mechanics at the age of 86. Cancer survivor, he's always calling me up and telling me about the
that's
spin
fantastic.
On the electron and
Man, that's, you know, my dad is also 86, but that's fantastic. Oh man.
And it's I'm so
well, that's inspiring. You mean I might actually be trying to learn something in 20 years?
Yeah, he's really I mean, he sends me these stuff.
God willing, may I live so long.
Yeah, it's, well, aging in America, you know, we spend, 18% of our GDP and more on healthcare, but it's the best 18% that we're spending. And, you know, people can talk about the financial sector and what are we getting out of it? You know, my dad's cancer surgeon, I hope he lives in a really nice house.
I hear you.
which I think he does, by the way.
Yeah, well, that's a real thing. Saving somebody's life is definitely real. Okay, Harold, thank you very much. I think it's going to be great. I'm going to sign off.
Okay, it was great to talk to you, John.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.